Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. Today, we start the show with a simple question. How does your family cook rice?
I feel like the how to cook rice is kind of a tricky question. It's like, you know, what kind of rice are you looking for?
I usually use basmati rice at home for most of my cooking.
My family cooks Thai jasmine rice. In Thai, it's called homily rice, which is medium grain rice from Thailand that is scented with jasmine flowers.
We generally do it the Asian way, which is just put your index finger up to the first line.
I add enough water to come up to my first knuckle of my index finger. So if you stick your index finger into the water so that the tip is touching the rice, then the water should come up to the first knuckle.
We use one part rice and then a little bit more than one part water. So maybe like 1.1 times water.
I generally like to cook on a stovetop. It gives me a little bit more control over the heat.
I cook my rice in a pressure cooker. I usually use Japanese short grain rice, so I add 1 to 1.1, the rice to water ratio. I cook it on medium pressure for 5 minutes and then do a quick release and it's done.
I have a great little Japanese rice cooker at home, so I pretty much cook all my rice in that.
So I do something really simple. What I do is I take how much rice I need and I put it in a fine mesh sieve and then place it under a tap with cold running water and let it rinse off till the runoff is no longer cloudy.
I was taught growing up to wash the rice in the rice cooker pot. So I would, you know, put the grains in, add enough water to cover by half an inch or so, and just like cold or room temperature, just not hot. And then swish it around. Actually, it's more than swishing. It's really rubbing the grains between my hands, between my fingers, until the water is really milky white.
One thing I do not do, and I tell people don't do this, is to go in and fidget with the rice as you're washing it too much. If you keep doing that, the runoff will keep being cloudy. It won't, you know, turn clear. And that's because you're creating friction by moving all those grains back and forth together quite aggressively.
So the water's not totally clear by the end, actually. It's still probably a little starchy.
I do wash the rice. I wash it at least 10 times until the water runs clear.
Whoa!
Yeah. We're a little obsessive over rice in the Japanese household.
I mean, if I'm honest, I have like 4 different rice cookers. And I do sometimes still just make rice on the stovetop. I have a really basic one. I have one with the sort of bells and whistles that I find incredibly convenient, like timers, you know, and set, you know, various settings, brown rice settings, quick cooking settings. I have a Persian rice cooker that makes the tadig in the cooker, which is really great. Is that it? Yeah, then I think that might be it. Oh, and then I have like a huge one like in storage that, you know, you can make for a really big crowd.
This deceptively simple question, how does your family cook rice, reveals volumes. Rice isn't just an ingredient or an accompaniment. For many people, it is life, it's identity, which is why Professor Amber Spry uses this simple prompt, something I've heard called a rice breaker, at the beginning of each of her semesters. Dr. Spry is a professor of identity politics at Brandeis University. Hi, Amber. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for inviting me to be part of this conversation.
Can you talk about your curriculum and why you posed this particular question the first day of class?
Yeah, so I teach a course called Identity Politics in the United States, and it's one of my favorite courses to teach, and that's because it engages so many different perspectives. So every year, I start with an activity to kind of get students thinking about their relationship to culture. Rice, I think, is a familiar ingredient across the globe. Almost every student has something to say about it. And I also, for selfish reasons, I just love hearing how different families prepare rice dishes. But asking students to share their experience with something where perspectives vary so widely is also useful because it models for the class early on that our answers to some questions are going to be different depending on the background that we have when we enter a conversation. We talk about a specific definition of identity politics in my class, which is that identity politics responds to the notion that different groups can have different, sometimes conflicting preferences and goals and needs. And so I thought Rice was a really good way of getting into that discussion.
I would imagine that the discussion could fill the entire time allotted for the class. How do students respond?
It's funny. Some students are so passionate when they're given a chance to talk about something that's so deeply connected to feelings of home and family and familiarity. There are some students who give these really detailed descriptions of how their families make rice, and there are other students for whom rice is kind of not something that they were familiar with at home. It's something that they experienced once they left home and started, you know, getting out on their own. And so the thing that's kind of useful about this question is that it causes us to think about our relationships to experience. How do we all experience the same phenomenon in very different ways?
Do any of the students become aware of the point of the exercise, or is there an aha moment when you reveal your intention?
Some students, the connection happens really early on, and I think those tend to be the students for whom identity is a very accessible part of their lived experience. And then other students, it takes a little bit longer for them to make the connection between talking about rice and things that they grew up with and this sort of metacognitive goal of the exercise, which is to make us realize some important aspects of our relationships to culture and to one another.
So how does your family cook rice?
So I'm really fortunate to have grown up in a family that embraced our cultures and celebrated that. I identify as Black American, and my grandmother is from the Philippines. So I also have ties to my Filipino heritage. And so I learned to cook rice the way that my grandmother cooks rice, which is you rinse the rice in water, and then you measure the amount of water using the first knuckle on your finger. So no matter what quantity of rice I'm cooking, I always know exactly what proportion of water to rice. And it comes out perfect every time.
This has been a particularly difficult year in social politics. Do you find that your coursework has changed at all because of the social climate, or is America just waking up?
I think both of those things might be true at the same time. I think the questions that I engage in this class are as relevant now as they've ever been. I think maybe the difference is that more people are wanting to be part of the language, and especially wanting to have a way of engaging in that conversation, right? And so one of the things that I do in this class is just provide a vocabulary for people to talk about questions that have probably been on the minds of many Americans for quite a while. A classic definition of politics is who gets what, when, and how. And so I think now more than ever, people are interrogating the way that power works in the world, right? Politics at its core is really about power. And I think identity politics can sometimes get a bad rap because, you know, it's a term that tends to get used without any conceptual clarity. But I want people to think about identity politics as a lens through which we can understand how social categories have a role in determining who gets what, when, and how.
So interesting. Thank you for your rice breaker. I think it's genius.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat together and for having a series that's so close to my heart.
That's Dr. Amber Spry, Assistant Professor of African American Studies and Politics at Brandeis University, where she teaches a class on identity politics in the United States. Coming up, we share two histories of American rice. one in the American South, and one in California. That's when good food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Today, we're talking about rice. For some people, a meal isn't a meal without bread made from wheat flour. For many here in Los Angeles, sitting at a table without a corn tortilla in one hand is unthinkable. But for much of the American South, it's rice that turns a collection of dishes into a meal. Michael Twitty is an African-American Jewish writer, culinary historian, and educator. His personal journey of self-discovery resulted in the groundbreaking work, The Cooking Gene. In his latest book, he turns his attention to rice. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy that you're here with us. So let's talk about rice in the South. Do we know when it arrived and how?
It shows up in various places in the 1680s. We know that in Virginia on the James River, there are Africans who are growing rice on the James. And it's probably because rice in the seed form arrived on slave ships. There is a popular myth about rice being woven into people's hair so that people would have something to eat. That's not how it went down, but that story doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of a multinational, transnational folklore that really does say that, but it doesn't really mean that. Like many things that enslaved people did, they talked in code. But for some reason that's caught on as a story, it sounds very empowering, but it's not likely accurate. And mostly because on the journey over, on the Middle Passage, there were rampant pests. And that would not have worked very well for someone to have rice in their hair. But we do know that in South Carolina, the popular folk history is that there was a ship from Madagascar that got almost wrecked in the coast near Charleston. And as sort of a gift for allowing them to, you know, get supplies and, you know, mend the ship, they were given a cask of rice seed from Madagascar. That's probably sort of in the zone, but we do know that African rice, Oryza glabrima, which was not commercially viable, which was indigenous to West Africa, a domesticated crop, We think between 5,000 and 3,000 years old. And first, of course, it starts as a gathered rice, and then it's a domesticated rice. So we're thinking the late 17th century for mainland North America.
So once rice arrives in the American South, who was cooking it first and for whom?
I'm gonna safely say that the Europeans, especially the British and the Germans and the French, were not the ones cooking that rice. Now, folks who came from Spain and Portugal, who were in many parts of the Americas, folks who came from the Po River Valley in Italy, folks who were Sephardic Jewish, folks who had any semblance of Middle Eastern culture, they would have probably known what to do with rice. But time and time again, northeastern Brazil, Africans, the Abonite region of Haiti, Africans, Veracruz, Africans in Mexico, rice in different parts of South America, Africans, and in the United States, what became the United States, Africans. We all, time and time again, the association of Africans with the growing of rice. In fact, Louisiana, we missed a lot of anniversaries in 2019, one of which was the 300-year presence of Africans in Louisiana, whereas the French crown does some dealings and Louisiana is sent a cask of rice from Benin. Again, this is probably plantation rice, and Africans from Benin to grow that rice. And rice becomes a staple food crop in Louisiana, a plantation crop, and then after the Civil War remains a major cash crop. So it's really difficult to not associate stories of New World rice without talking about enslaved Africans and their labor and know-how, which is more than just putting in the ground. It's shaping the earth. It's directing the water. It's doing all the major parts of a crop. And that takes more than just brute labor. That's geometry. That's amateur botany at its finest. It's a lot of different connections to nature.
Do you have a rice dish personally that stands out above all others?
My personal favorite, and I love to talk about it, is red rice. And red rice has been known as Spanish rice. Ain't nothing Spanish about it. You can also call it arroz mexicana. Mexican rice comes from the African presence in Mexico. You can call it, you know, Brazilian rice in some cases. You can call it tomato pilau perlu. Perlu is the right word. And it's even been called mulatto rice, which shows you something. But red rice is, I would call it the granddaughter of Benetton and Chebogen and Jollof rice in West Africa. All of which, you know, I have to admit, are contemporary words for a type of dish that's been around for quite some time, but probably did not achieve sort of like a name and a recipe until after colonialism. And that's so important to keep in mind, is that not everything was named and claimed before the coming of the Europeans. You know, people didn't always categorize their world in the same terms by which people conveniently do so today. And in Western culture, this is African culture. In African culture, it's a very different thing about how you talk about food and what goes in it and where. But inevitably, red rice contains tomatoes, maybe tomato paste, in a contemporary recipe, bell pepper, and onion, which is for us in the Afro-Atlantic world. Either that or hot peppers is like our food trinity. That's like the base that goes into a lot of things. Sometimes we talk about garlic, sometimes we talk about celery and other elements, but it's the tomatoes, the peppers, and the onions that really sort of signify that African presence.
Can you take me through the dish, how you make it, and share the history of different ingredients within it, but also its meaning for you? I know that you've done a lot of work to figure out where your family lies in Africa. And I know that your grandmother made this dish. So take us through.
Red rice is the closest thing I have to something that may have roots in sort of a transatlantic context directly. And so you start with sauteing the onion and the bell pepper and the garlic, whatever she goes, you're going to use. And then in goes the rice. And you kind of like sweat that for a bit. And then in comes the broth. You can use vegetable broth, chicken broth, whatever. And the tomato. And we like to steam our rice to the point where the grains are separate and distinct. We don't like, the rice should not be flooded with a lot of liquid. And you should always realize that tomatoes are liquid too. And there's a balance. And I don't know how to describe it, to be honest with you, because it's just by sight, and it's also just kind of like watching my grandmother and my mother cook and other ladies who were closer to the source cook. My grandmother was from Alabama, but her great-grandmother had been sold in Alabama from South Carolina and from a very mixed line. It's an important thing to say because colorism and also just like who is Black and who is not Black is a very complicated thing to talk about backwards in your history. So for me, learning that my sixth great grandmother was Mende from Sierra Leone was an extraordinary vindication of what we always knew deep down, which was people who claimed that they only had so much African blood or Black blood or whatever you want to call it on that line were really just performing sort of a strange sort of self-loathing imposed by Jim Crow society that also had a weird and uncomfortable balance of privilege and vulnerability that was for women who were lighter skinned, who were obviously the products of sexual violence on plantations. And I think that if anyone's listening to this and going, oh God, or rolling eyes, I just want them to understand that that's why I think people of color, Black and brown people, are especially passionate about this, about food, the politics of food ownership and cultural appropriation, other issues. It's because, you know, for other people, they can just waltz in on a recipe and, you know, do what they want with it and take it on off. And for us, we have to go through a certain amount of clarity, a certain amount of courage to work through those traumas and those triggers that belie every single thing we've ever done in the New World. And at the same point in time, I think it's critical to remember that our greatest form of capital is how we've survived and managed to overcome our oppression and marginalization.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
That's Michael Twitty, author of The Cooking Gene and his latest, Rice, from the Savor the South series. America's a wheat nation. We grow it, we export it, we subsidize it, and you know, we've got those great plains. I'll never forget the interview I did years ago with a social psychologist about the difference in personality traits between wheat-growing communities and rice-growing communities. Rice requires many hands. Wheat can be sowed by one individual in a John Deere. It's no surprise that America, a country that is obsessed with individualism, would primarily grow wheat. But like anything in America, the story of rice is not monolithic. Just look at California, where rice has been grown in the regions surrounding the Sacramento Valley for more than a century. Unlike rice varieties found in the American South, short and medium grain Japanese rice varieties like Kel Rose, Koshi Hikari, and Akita Komachi have been the most successful here. If there is rice royalty in California, then Robin Cota and her brother Ross of Cota Family Farms are it. Many of you know Robin Cota from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She joins us this morning to talk about her family legacy. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Evan.
Oh, it's so great to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your grandfather who started the farm. He was quite the entrepreneur and an activist, I understand.
Yep, it's actually sort of a lot to measure up to. So I always feel like we're playing catch up with our grandfather, but he was a tremendous influence and a great example to aspire to. And he came to America essentially to seek his fortune. In Japan, if you weren't the firstborn son, it was basically nothing was going, I mean, there was really not much potential there. So I find that a lot of Japanese immigrants back at the turn of the century, last century, the men were usually not firstborn sons. So America was a land of opportunity. My grandfather was ambitious and he took off as soon as he could.
What year was this?
He came over to America in 1908, and by the early 20s, he had accumulated enough money to start looking for land.
I mean, that's pretty fast to come with basically nothing and just constantly trade up through your entrepreneurship to acquire land.
It is. It is. His determination is just mind-boggling. And, you know, just personally speaking, very candidly, it's kind of a ball and chain.
So may I ask how your family managed to keep the farm during the World War II internment of Japanese Americans?
Well, the short answer to that is they didn't. By the outbreak of World War II, there was so much anti-Asian sentiment already in place. Alien land law was put into place in 1913. So that sentiment was really growing. And my grandfather recognized that the best thing to do to hopefully keep the business intact was to shut it down, just shutter everything completely. And that's what he wanted to do. But we don't know how, at least this generation doesn't know how, government caught wind that they're planning to shut down and then literally mandated that they stay open and running to produce fiber. And of course, I mean, how does that work when your family is interned in a Japanese internment camp several states away behind barbed wire? It doesn't, right? So they were forced to sign over power of attorney to non-Asians. And the minute that happened, essentially the farm started to be dismantled.
And so at the end of World War II, when your family was finally released, did he have to start over from scratch?
He essentially did. They were interned at Amachi, which is in Colorado, and they literally drove nonstop back to get to the farm to see what had happened. And essentially the farm, there was very little left. The milling operation itself, the processing plant itself was no longer theirs. They lost most of their acreage, which before the war was upwards of 5,000 acres. They lost the majority of that. They lost their homes. They had livestock. My grandfather had over 1,000 head of hog at that time, because back then there wasn't a secondary market for byproducts like the rice bran, which we now know does have value, but back then there wasn't. So he had a hog farm alongside that. All that was gone. All their equipment was gone. All the best equipment was gone. They had a couple of airplanes for aerial seeding. Those are gone. Essentially, the land that was left was a crazy quilt patchwork of just stuff here and there. Before the war, part of what my grandfather wanted to streamline farming was to have land that was very closely located to get together, contiguous acreage. And so after the war, everything was just crazy patch, a couple acres here, a couple acres there. So my grandfather, to his credit, just literally packed up what little there was left and moved literally a quarter mile down the road and started rebuilding a new facility with his two young adult sons then. And I mean, when you think about it, that is incredible. I mean, to this day, that mill is still standing there. It's derelict. It hasn't been in use since, say, I don't know, maybe the 80s. And to look at that as a reminder every day of your life, I just don't know how he bared it, but he did. And to me, that's a great illustration of just how diligent, how determined he was to get back on his feet.
During the past couple of weeks, it's been the Lunar New Year's, and in covering that, we've heard a lot about different dishes made with sticky rice. And your family was the first in California to grow sweet rice, what we sometimes call mochi rice or glutinous rice. Can you describe what it is and how it differs from table rice or sushi rice?
Yes, I can. So the word sweet is sort of a misnomer. It's not necessarily any sweeter than any other rice, but for whatever reason, that has just stuck. And it describes a very short kernel of rice, again, in the Japonica class. It is super, super sticky. So whereas you think of sushi rice being sticky, this is just like crank it on up, this thing you can put up wallpaper with, okay? It's that sticky. So the shorter the grain of rice is, the higher the starch content. So sweet rice or mochi rice, when you look at the kernel itself, it's going to be chalky. It's not going to be kind of a translucent, pearlescent kernel of rice like other sushi or table rice looks like. For newcomers cooking in a pot, it's sometimes just overwhelming.
It's so good. How was it received when your family first brought it to market in America? What was it, primarily for the Japanese-American market?
It was equally, I would say, for the Chinese American market, because the Chinese actually use more of it than Japanese. And at that time, the Chinese were very, very, very discerning about the sweet rice. And my father, who was involved with the marketing back then, can remember visiting Chinese customers, and they would literally stick their hand into a bag of sweet rice and drag out their hand. And if they spotted one kernel of table rice, they would just have a fit. So we essentially were known for the purity of our sweet rice. So meaning there was no commingling of the two types of rice or any other types of rice within it.
How do you use it in your kitchen? What is a dish that you make more frequently using the sweet rice?
One of the most beloved preparations using mochi rice is something we call osekihan. And it is essentially your sweet rice cooked with adzuki beans. And adzuki beans are an Asian bean that is essentially kind of a dark red. And when you cook it, it'll color things pink. So you parboil these beans, you add them to your rice, and then cook your rice, and your rice comes out this beautiful, delicate pink color, and you have the beans mixed in. You would then traditionally finish that with a sprinkling of salt and sesame seeds, black sesame seeds. But that is definitely something you'll see on birthdays, holidays. Another one of my more recent favorite ways to prepare our sweet rice is to make something called a Chinese, the recipe I was given, they just call it literally Chinese sticky rice. And it's just full of delicious little meat tidbits like Chinese sausage and Chinese duck liver sausage and peanuts and dried scallops and dried shrimp. And you cook it all up in one pot and it is just delicious.
Sounds delicious. Thank you so much, Robin. It's been truly wonderful talking to you.
Oh, well, likewise, Evan.
That was Robin Koda of Koda Farms. You can find her family's rice at any local Japanese supermarket and at boutique outlets like Cookbook, Squirrel Away, and M Cafe. In a minute, do you love making paella? Well, beware of the paella police. And no, I'm not kidding. We have a cautionary tale when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Matt Goulding is a prolific author of books on food culture that also act as travel guides. And two of these books are deep dives into cultures in which rice is the focus. Rice Noodle Fish, about Japanese food culture, and Grape Olive Pig, which focuses on Spain. He's a co-founder of Roads and Kingdoms and a co-author of Eat This, Not That. But it was a recent Instagram post that caused me to pick up the phone and give him a call. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Evan. How's it going?
Good. So let's talk about that Instagram post. The photo was of what most of us would call a paella, a beautiful one. But the first sentence of your text is, don't call it a paella. The paella police in Valencia will come for you. Seriously, those dudes are vicious.
They are. It's funny. Before actually posting that, I had sent a photo of the same rice dish to Jose Andres, who I've written a book with and who's been a close friend for years and been somewhat of a paella sage for me, or a rice sage, you might say. And he said, beautiful and nice work, just don't call it a paella. He knows as well as I do, as he's been sort of tagged by the vicious paella police of Valencia before, that you have to be very careful what you call a paella when it comes to sort of regional Spanish cooking.
So let's talk about the dish. You say in your book that you can find the entire history of Spain within the perimeter of a paella pan.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's, for me, the complete picture of the country. You know, when you start with something like the base of the paella pan, which is olive oil, you know, that's sort of the Roman Empire and its expansion across into the Iberian Peninsula. When you look at the tomato that forms the sofrito in the base of it, that's part of Spain's own expansive sort of empire movements in the New World, where they brought back, you know, tomato along with so many other things in the sort of the Columbus era. You know, and of course, the key to it is the rice itself, along with the saffron and many of the vegetables that came up from Northern Africa in the 7th, 8th, 9th century as sort of a caliphate was established, and Al-Andalus was sort of what the Iberian Peninsula was known as for hundreds of years. And that residue of those kind of that rice-growing culture is still very, very strong to this day, especially in and around Valencia. where you have a lot of fresh water, you have estuaries, you have lagoons and lakes, and you have these kind of floodplains where short grain rice grows very, very well. So you have bomba, B-O-M-B-A. That's sort of the rice that we know as the sort of the paella rice. There's Calasparra, which is named after a town not far outside of Valencia, which is again another kind of short, fat, plump rice, as well as Senia. And they all kind of behave the same way, which is to say they take in a lot of liquid, but they hold their structure very, very well. So you're able to kind of have a deeply flavored rice, but still have that, you know, they still have that texture, still have a little bit of that resistance when you bite into a paella or to a rice dish that I think, you know, Spaniards absolutely adore.
How different are these varieties from the Italian arborio rice that's used for risotto?
They're actually very, very similar. A great risotto comes out essentially al dente, right? I mean, you've got just the tiniest little undercurrent of bite to it. Not so much that it's actually raw in its center. That's ultimately the goal of a great paella as well.
One of the things that I find so fascinating about paella in particular is the method in which the dish is built. It's so rare that you see rice in such a thin layer and also cooked without a lid. You know, in America, we always want to put a lid on the rice. We want to steam the rice. So could you sort of take us through that? Like, how old is the pan? Why do we have this pan?
So the pan came about, I mean, the idea of the paella came about sort of in the orange fields of Valencia, right? So you have people who were, you know, sort of farming and harvesting this incredible crop, you know, that we all know, the Valencian orange, you know, throughout the last 300-400 years. And essentially building lunch with the products that were around them. So rice was being grown because it's been grown in Spain since the 8th or 9th century. You had chicken or rabbits, as well as a few of the vegetables. In this case, it'd be kind of a fat white bean, as well as kind of a thick, almost kind of Romano-style green bean. And those all became kind of the main constituents of it. But the pan itself was wide and flat because it allowed for quick cooking. It also doubled as the serving vessel. So you can cook a paella relatively quick because the liquid evaporates very quickly in that scenario. And you also have people that then essentially, after cooking the paella over a live fire, you know, historically it's been cooked over, you know, dried orange wood, then you gather around the pan and you eat. And to this day, that's still how I think when you go to a Valencian home or you go to the right restaurant, they'll ask you if you want a plate, and you can certainly have a plate if you want. But the real way to do it is you take your spoon, not even your fork, but your spoon. And traditionally it's a wooden spoon, so it doesn't conduct heat against the kind of the hot bottom or the hot surface of that pan. And you carve out your quarter or your sixth or your eighth little triangle from that paella pan as if you were taking a pizza slice. And that is your real estate. That is your rice that you get to eat.
How important is the charred layer on the bottom of the pan?
It's everything. I mean, for me, it's the whole reason to eat a paella. It's called socarrat, right? And so that happens, that sort of magical formation of crispy rice forms in the last 30 seconds or a minute when cooking a paella. And when you're doing it over an open fire, what you would do is you'd throw in a last few pieces of kindling, small little twigs, really dry pieces of wood that can sort of stoke the fire and give you that last blast of heat.
So I just want to talk briefly about the paella police. There's this thing called Wiki Paella.
Exactly. So the Wiki Paella, they established back in 2012 or 13 as they watched paella become kind of this global phenomenon. And they were worried that it was being diluted or being bastardized. And it was getting a bad name because when people were eating bad versions of it, they thought, well, what's so special about this rice dish? Well, for them, this rice dish is absolutely sacrosanct. And so what they did is they formed a database after talking to hundreds and hundreds of paella chefs and cooks around Valencia and around Alicante, the main regions of rice cooking in Spain. And they came up with sort of a database that shows not only the restaurants that are doing it really well, but also kind of offering recipes for the home cook to understand, you know, what is truly at the core of a paella. And they are the ones that Jose will always remind me when we talk, you know, don't call it a paella unless it has rabbit, chicken, snails, the white beans of Valencia, the fat green beans of Valencia, and almost nothing else. If it has other things in it, make sure you call it arroz con cosas, which is sort of the catch-all, rice with things, which kind of keeps you out of trouble. And that trouble is real, though. I mean, I think the best example of someone who got in trouble for calling something a paella that wasn't was Jamie Oliver, who came to Spain, who's a big lover of Spanish culture, but made a big show out of making a paella that had chorizo and green peas in it, which was absolutely sacrilegious for the Valencians. And, you know, the entire region and eventually the entire country was up in arms. There were op-eds, there were essays lambasting this poor guy. And it really affected him. I mean, I remember listening to an interview where Jamie was basically like, I had no idea how many people I was offending by doing my riff on a Spanish rice. That's kind of what started my post, you know, that post on Instagram was like, you know what? I'm not even going to bother calling this a paella because I don't want to get crucified. You know, I just want to go ahead and eat my rice the right way.
There you go. Thank you so much, Matt.
Always a pleasure, Evan.
Matt Goulding is a food writer. His marvelous book, Grape Olive Pig, focuses on the food culture of Spain. And you can see his definitely not paella Instagram post on his feed at MD Goulding. When we talk about appliances that transform women's work, the rice cooker should have a halo pulsating around it. Before the automatic rice cooker arrived, making rice for a family three times a day was the task that many Japanese housewives found most onerous. It was time-consuming and required constant attention. Eventually, the electronic geniuses of Japan would solve the problem and liberate generations of cooks. Anne Eubank wrote about the battle to invent the automatic rice cooker for Atlas Obscura. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. How's it going?
I'm so glad to have you here. We're all fascinated by this subject. Historically, how was rice made in Japan?
So for centuries, people would cook rice on these really big wood-burning stoves that had iron pots installed into them. And to make really good rice, you have to, you know, apply really high heat and then low heat. And then to finish off the rice, you need to apply high heat again. So, you know, doing that on a stove where you can't just turn a little dial to turn the heat up or down, it's very difficult. So it's really, cooking rice on a wood-burning stove was an art. And there were people doing this several times a day.
So who jumped in to create a solution? When did the search to try and find an electronic solution start?
So it starts very early in the 20th century. You know, people were making electrical rice cookers right away. Almost as soon as electricity was available in Japan, there was, you know, there were restaurants with these like big industrial rice cookers, and the military made a version in the 30s, but there was nothing for the home. And so that didn't really start until 1945, when an engineer named Masaru Ibuka, he started a small company in an abandoned department store. And his thing and what his team did was that they fixed radios. But oftentimes they were paid in rice, because this was post-war Japan. Things were very difficult. And Masaru Ibuka is now more famous. He's the founder of Sony, the massive, you know, consumer electronic company, Sony. But their very first invention was an electric rice cooker.
Was it successful? Was it embraced?
It was a complete failure. It was just a disaster. And so they actually have one of these prototypes in a museum in Japan at the Sony Museum. And you look at it and it's incredibly rustic looking. It's a wooden tub with a electrical circuit set in the bottom. And Ibuka, for years afterwards, he would explain like why he thought it went wrong. And he maintained that it would only work with really good quality rice that would absorb water evenly. And this was not the kind of rice that a lot of people had access to, especially at this time. And so it would result in such terrible rice. And it was kind of a small disaster for the company because, you know, they had bought all of these like wooden tubs to make it in. And these tubs were just lined up everywhere around their warehouse. And so they gave up when they went back to fixing radios. And that's, you know, that was kind of the start of the company. And so no one tried again for several years.
Was there a part of this fallow time of people not trying, the fact that these were mostly men and it was kind of a non-problem, as in thinking that any Japanese wife who couldn't deliver on making rice on her own was kind of a failed housewife?
Oh, absolutely. No one went and asked the women who were going to be the future consumers of household products and household appliances, no one went and asked them what they needed or what product would make their lives easier. Until a few years later, in the very early 1950s, there was a Toshiba salesman named Shogo Yamada. And he had a lot of success going around Japan selling electric washing machines for Toshiba. And while he was doing this, he decided that he was going to ask these women that he was selling these machines to, he was going to ask them, like, what is the chore that you hate the most? What is your most onerous chore? And they all said, cooking rice. And Shogo was shocked. So many of these, like, engineers and executives, they had just never thought about it, you know. Makiko Ito, the writer who I interviewed for this article, she said that at this point, many of these men had probably never gone into a kitchen.
So this is the moment I love, when you have Shogo Yamada, the salesman who's going around Japan and who's listening to all these women, and then a man comes and asks him for work, Yoshitada Minami, and he has this secret weapon.
Yeah. So that secret weapon was Yoshitada Minami himself. He was a water heater maker who had fallen on really hard times. And so he comes and asks Shogo for work. And Shogo says, all right, I'm going to give this project to you. And, you know, Yoshitada, he's not a cook. He's a water heater maker. So he immediately turns to his wife, Fumiko. And Fumiko is a rice cooking expert. Fumiko still uses a Kamado at this point, and she cooks rice several times a day for the couple's six children. And so she's Yoshitada's secret weapon. She turned out to be Toshiba's secret weapon. Yoshitada would build prototypes, and she was the one who had to test them. You know, Fumiko was in charge of perfecting this product, but in the end, you know, Shogo had to go ask Toshiba for a certain component that would actually make these machines work. He went to his bosses and they handed over a bimetallic strip of metal that would bend once it reached 100 degrees Celsius. And so what Fumiko knew and what we now know is that rice is done when all of the water in the pot has either been absorbed into the rice or has disappeared as steam. And so water can only reach 100 degrees Celsius before it becomes steam. So they installed this little piece of metal into these rice cookers, and that was the switch that would turn off the rice cooker once the temperature of the rice exceeded 100 degrees Celsius, because while water can't exceed 100 degrees Celsius, rice can. And so to keep the rice from burning, the little metal switch would bend and turn the whole pot off. And in the mid-50s, it went to market.
Once it hit the market, how quickly was it embraced?
You know, at first, there was some trouble. Because it was double-potted, it was quite expensive. And so actually, Shogo, who again was in charge of going around and like distributing these pots, actually, housewives were kind of reluctant at first to pay the price for these, until he showed them that it could make this complicated rice dish, takikomi gohan. And so that convinced everybody. And so within a year, Toshiba was producing 200,000 rice cookers every month. It was incredible. And it kicked off an arms race amongst all the other consumer electronics companies in Japan.
Well, thank you so much. Your article is fascinating.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it.
That's Anne Eubank. We've been discussing the history of the rice cooker. To read her full piece, visit the link to Atlas Obscura on our website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, we learn about a mother-daughter duo selling gorgeous domes of fragrant golden Persian rice. Their story is up next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. There is rice, then there is basmati, the long, separate, aromatic grains expressing vast territories of culture with each bite. It is thought that most pilaf-like dishes enriched with spices and vegetables and/or meat can be traced back to the Persian Empire. In our time, the tadig, the golden, crunchy circle of rice that forms slowly at the bottom of the pot while the separate grains steam above, has found a wide audience. Mother-daughter duo Farah and Sophia Parsa make a special dish featuring this golden circle. Their business is Golden Rice Co. And Sophia joins us for this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Sophia Parsa. I'm a partner at Golden Rice Co. Golden Rice Co. has been started by my family. In the kitchen is my mom, and I sort of handle the day-to-day operations and marketing. The business is a restaurant pop-up that allows our customers to pre-order a beautiful tajine dish. Tajine is a very traditional Persian food that typically is made in the oven. It's a fluffy, almost like rice cake. It's infused with saffron. It has oil in it. It has yogurt in it. It has eggs in it. And it really almost mimics like a rice cake. What's unique about our golden rice dish, our tajine, is that the top layer, the dome, is really crispy. And we put that tadig top over the tajine dish stovetop. Not only are you getting this traditional tajine dish that has so much flavor, but you're also getting that thing about tadig that people just, you know, they call it the gold of the rice, which is the top, the crispy layer. And tadig literally translates to the bottom of the pot, and that's where the crispy forms. You know, growing up, my mom had always been cooking and keeping our doors open for anyone who wanted to join us for dinner. At some point in my career, I started hosting these supper club dinner events in my backyard. We were hosting 100 people for dinner and discussion. And at the first meeting, we noticed that we were short on food. And really, my mom noticed that we were short on food. And like any Middle Eastern mother, she jumped on the opportunity to cook for us. Just a few months before that, I lost my father, who she was typically cooking for. And I noticed that she lost the sense of purpose. And the minute that she had the opportunity to cook for people again, it brightened her in a way that I haven't seen her in many months. And from there, we started hosting these monthly dinners for 5 years, and it was always centered around her cooking and the foods that I was raised on. When the pandemic hit, we realized that gathering would, of course, not be allowed, but also not be appropriate. And so we were sort of thinking about how can my mom continue to fulfill this passion of hers that she so much enjoyed while cooking for these dinners. And so we put our menu from my dinner series onto Instagram. And from there, we just started accepting orders. And people started ordering. And 1 week after the next, it started to grow. And eventually, we needed a real kitchen. We went from cooking in my mom's home with plugins and stovetop, and things were probably not kosher. And eventually we got to a place where we have a beautiful kitchen with 20 burners, and we're really able to do more than we could have ever imagined. Some memories I have of my mom's cooking is just the way that the basmati rice, which is really a staple dish in our culture, the tadig is sort of like the scent of my home. And even, you know, last night I visited my mom and it still smells like tadig in her house almost every day. And that really is nostalgic for me. And not only is it, you know, something that I'm dealing with at Golden Rice Co. generally, but this sense of smell that the basmati rice is so known for, that like sort of takes over the scent of the home, is just super comforting for me. I think one of the most interesting things about my mom as I watch her cook is, you know, I could never get a recipe from her. you know, I'll try and learn from her techniques, and she'll say, just do it this way and just pinch this and just take a handful of that. And what's funny is when I measure her pinches and handfuls, they're always exact to what she thinks it is. So my mom just has an eye for cooking, and you can really taste the soulfulness and the love in her food. You know, of course, with any family business, there's challenges. There's different opinions. We come from very different backgrounds, very different generations. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. She was born and raised in Tehran. And what's so cool about what we're doing is you have two people who are very good at very different things. And when you combine the two, it creates magic, which I think is what we've been able to do and accomplish over the last few months. If you were to order from Golden Rice Co., there are three items that pop up to mind for me as like my favorites. The first is, of course, our original golden rice with chicken. If dairy is not an issue for you, and I'm not talking cream or anything like that, just simple yogurt and eggs. If that's not an issue for you, definitely order that with our chicken. Please order the mas. The mas tohiyar is a sort of yogurt and cucumber dip. And people always laugh at me when I say order the yogurt to put on top of your yogurt rice. I really literally mean that. I know the rice is prepared with yogurt, but you should absolutely put the yogurt cucumber dip on top of the yogurt rice. It is just a flavor that's indescribable, and it makes it so fresh. And last, we have homemade ice cream. A friend of mine actually started making ice cream in the pandemic, and I gave her two flavor profiles that are typical Persian flavor ice creams. So I would say those are my three favorites on the menu that you absolutely should try.
That was Sophia Parsa. Along with her mother, she owns and operates Golden Rice Co., a once-a-week pop-up serving their signature tahin. Find them on Instagram at Golden Rice Co. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I hope today's show made you hungry. I, for one, cannot wait to make Michael Twitty's red rice for dinner tonight. The recipe is at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'll be back in 1 week with an all-new episode of Good Food.